Hello and welcome back to Surgery 101, brought to you with the help of the Department of Surgery at the University of Alberta. As always, we're available on the iTunes Music Store, at surgery101.org, at MedEd Portal, and on the Canadian Healthcare Education Commons. Just this week, Surgery 101 was mentioned in the monthly newsletter of CAGS, which is the Canadian Association of General Surgeons. So we'd like to say hi to all the general surgeons in Canada, and to welcome any new listeners we have this week. In the last few weeks, we have been covering some topics in speciality surgery, and you'll notice we're on a bit of a neurosurgery binge at the moment, but we do have some new topics coming up in general surgery over the next few weeks. So please do keep listening. This week, we'll be hearing again from neurosurgeon Dr. Cian O'Kelly, who'll be addressing the topic of intracerebral hemorrhage. He'll be telling us why it's important, what the risk factors for the condition are, how patients with intracerebral hemorrhage present, how you make the diagnosis and what investigations are required, and lastly, what are the indications for surgery with intracerebral hemorrhage. So, let's get ready to talk about bleeding in the brain here on Surgery 101. Okay, so here we go. How do we define intracerebral hemorrhage? What is it that we're actually talking about?
Spontaneous intracerebral hemorrhage is defined as bleeding into the brain parenchyma that is not associated with trauma. This accounts for 20% of all strokes and has the highest morbidity and mortality of all stroke subtypes. Incidence increases with advancing age, peaking between 65 and 80 years. There is a preponderance in males.
So I guess we're talking about something similar to subarachnoid hemorrhage, a topic we've covered recently here on Surgery 101. But this is a little bit different. This isn't bleeding into the subarachnoid space, this is bleeding into the brain itself. And it's obviously a bad thing, and it's a serious thing, and it's a major cause of strokes. If you remember, when we talked about subarachnoid hemorrhage, we said that most of those are caused by intracranial aneurysms, which rupture and cause bleeding into the subarachnoid space. So, what are the causes of this other sort of bleeding into the brain? What are the causes of intracerebral hemorrhage?
The causes of intracerebral hemorrhage include hypertension, which accounts for 70 to 90% of cases. Amyloid angiopathy is a common cause in the elderly. Other potential causes include aneurysm, arteriovenous malformation, anticoagulant use or clotting disorder, drug abuse, in particular cocaine and amphetamines, vasculitis, or tumor. Occasionally, intracerebral hemorrhages are caused by the hemorrhagic conversion of an ischemic infarct.
So that's quite different from subarachnoid hemorrhage then. A majority of cases of intracerebral hemorrhage are associated with hypertension instead of aneurysm formation. And this is something that occurs in elderly people, people who are on blood thinners, and sometimes in people who are abusing certain drugs. So, how do we recognize the patient who's having an intracerebral hemorrhage?
The common features of clinical presentation in these patients include elevated blood pressure in 90% of patients. 50% will have a focal neurologic deficit, many of which will be progressive over time. A decreased level of consciousness, headache, and vomiting are signs of increased intracranial pressure. These occur in about half the cases and are much more common than in ischemic stroke. It is important when considering the history of these patients whether there is known hypertension, known anticoagulant, or illicit drug use.
So let's say you have a patient in whom you suspect a spontaneous intracerebral hemorrhage. They present with headache, and vomiting. They perhaps have a decreased level of consciousness, perhaps they have some focal neurology, and high blood pressure. Obviously, bleeding within the brain is an intracranial catastrophe. Because the cranium is a closed space, it can't expand, and therefore bleeding in the brain increases intracranial pressure and damages perfusion to the brain itself. So what's the prognosis for patients with such an intracranial catastrophe? And how should such patients be managed initially?
Patients with intracerebral hemorrhage have the poorest prognosis of all stroke patients. 20 to 25% will be dead within 2 days, with 50% mortality at 30 days. Only 20% are found to be independent at 6 months. The initial management of these patients will include consideration of the ABCs. Coma will require airway management. Blood pressure will need to be moderated. The target mean arterial blood pressure is less than 130 millimeters of mercury. It must be kept in mind that these patients will have elevated intracranial pressure, and as such, their cerebral perfusion pressure should be maintained. These patients will all require supportive care and observation, usually within a neurointensive care setting.
So this is a bad situation. A lot of people with spontaneous intracerebral hemorrhage are going to die from the condition, and of those who don't die, the majority will suffer major morbidity. The objective of treatment is to try to prevent further damage to the brain, and that's done by securing the airway so that we can provide oxygenation for the brain, managing blood pressure so we can try to reduce further bleeding, while trying to maintain brain perfusion. Because of course, as the intracranial pressure rises, it gets harder and harder to supply blood to the brain. So let's talk investigation. What sort of tests should we consider in a patient like this?
The initial diagnostic test of choice is a plain CT scan, which will generally reveal the hemorrhage. Patients must be investigated for any coagulopathy and reversed accordingly. The next question will be, who needs further vascular imaging? This is dependent on three key characteristics: the patient's age, the history of hypertension, and a deep versus lobar location of the hemorrhage. Although each patient should be considered individually, patients who are above 50 years of age, have a deep hemorrhage, and a history of hypertension are almost certainly a hypertensive hemorrhage and may not require vascular imaging. Conversely, if the patient's age is less than 50, they have a lobar hemorrhage and no history of hypertension, then imaging and preferably a cerebral angiogram should be arranged. In very elderly patients, particularly with a history of dementia, a lobar hemorrhage is likely due to amyloid angiopathy. These are usually not investigated further. In most cases, a delayed MRI scan should be considered once the blood has resolved. This rules out the rare eventuality of an underlying tumor.
So we've talked about risk factors, we've talked about how the patient presents, we've talked about how to make the diagnosis and covered a little on the prognosis. And it all sounds fairly depressing. But what is the neurosurgeon's role here? Are there any indications for surgery in spontaneous intracerebral hemorrhage?
Surgery to evacuate the hemorrhage is only offered in selected cases. The blood clot needs to be surgically accessible with a reasonable safety profile. Therefore, deep hemorrhages located within the basal ganglia or thalamus cannot be safely removed, as the neurologic injury that would ensue is prohibitive. Other characteristics that favor a surgical approach include young patients with good premorbid function, location in a non-dominant hemisphere, non-comatose patients with GCS greater than 9, hemorrhages located within the temporal lobe or cerebellum are often evacuated, as these can cause brain herniation in a rapid fashion. Certainly, if an underlying lesion is detected, such as an arteriovenous malformation or tumor, these may require surgical removal to prevent rebleeding. Occasionally, these lesions can be treated with stereotactic radiosurgery if they are in deep or eloquent brain locations. To summarize, intracerebral hemorrhage is bleeding that occurs into the brain parenchyma. This is usually caused by hypertension. However, certain underlying lesions may be responsible. Patients require supportive intensive care management with lowering of their blood pressure and reversal of coagulopathy. In selected patients, further vascular imaging is required to determine whether an underlying lesion is associated. Selected patients, especially those who are young with superficial hemorrhage locations, are considered for surgical evacuation.
That's it for another episode of Surgery 101. We hope you find these podcasts useful, and we'd like to thank you for listening once again. As always, we're very keen to have suggestions for additional topics you'd like us to cover. So if you'd like to get in touch, please email us at surgerypodcast@gmail.com, leave a comment at surgery101.org, or send us a tweet at Canadian Surgeon on Twitter. That's all for this week, and we look forward to seeing you again next week, back here on Surgery 101.